Welcome to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Ryan Holiday. He's an author and media columnist for the New York Observer. This is Technotopia. Technotopia is brought to you by Typewriter. Typewriter is your on-demand editor, and their amazing team of writers will make your book chapter, blog post, or email shine. Typewriter editors come from places like TechCrunch, Gizmodo, and the New York Times, and they offer low bulk rates for longer work. Check it out at typewriter.plus. That's typewriter.plus. Welcome back to Technotopia, a podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Ryan Holiday, author, media columnist for the New York Observer, and his latest book is The Daily Stoic. Welcome, Ryan. I've been reading your books for a while now, learning how to become more stoic.
Yeah, I think stoicism is a good topic to connect to what we're going to talk about. I mean, it's about the sort of the passage of time and how man deals with it, both good and bad. So I'm excited.
Okay, so why don't you describe some of what you've been writing about specifically? You started out as sort of a media observer. You were an early guerrilla PR guy.
I started with marketing, and then I ended up writing about media. So I wrote a book that was sort of looking at the economics of the online media system and the way that affects culture and technology and the sort of the people in between all those things. And then I wrote a book a few years ago about Stoic philosophy called The Obstacle is the Way. And I actually think the two things intersect in a way that, you know, in ways that people don't necessarily get or see. Is it sort of one is the internal operating system, and then the other is the sort of analysis of the outside world. But I try to write my definition of stoicism is basically you don't control the world around you; you control how you respond. And so I try to write about how we should and could respond to things.
So why don't we go back to the media aspect? I remember distinctly. So you quoted me a lot in the book, and you quoted my book about blogging.
I quoted your book, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
So it was really interesting to read because I was coming at the book from a not a place of naivete, but I was coming from a place of this is how things get done, mm-hmm. and what we all of us in blogging were doing really early on is essentially ruining the world. And you noticed that pretty early. And I think that's a credit to you. And I think it's also been a hard pill to swallow, because I think media, as it stands now, has been reduced to either something really in depth and well thought out and unread, or something that pops up on the internet and disappears as quickly as possible and is read by millions of people. So what's our way forward in media?
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say in the book is basically that, and I came of age in this generation too, so it's like there was all this optimism about sort of citizen journalism, about these sort of positive forces that online media was going to bring to the world. It was going to create more participation. It was going to create more accuracy, less bias, less corruption, you know, less fluff, and it was going to create this sort of better world. Mm-hmm. And you know, the internet as the meritocracy where the good stuff comes to the top. And I think it was that for a brief period, perhaps, or maybe that was naivete. And then what happened is that the economics of that system ultimately won out over the idealism. So, you know, when you have people who are paid by how many posts they create lots of posts, and most of them aren't good. You know, when you pay people based on how many views their posts get instead, they create a different kind of post. And then I think on top of that, when everything is subject to sharing as the sort of main way to get an audience, what you get is a lot of opinion, a lot of sort of sensationalism, a lot of sort of provocation. And ultimately, people think that the information is separate from reality. Well, the problem is our reality reacts to the information that we get. So if you get a certain kind of information, then you get a world that responds to that information. It becomes this sort of weird, crazy loop. And so that's sort of what I was being critical of, not because I hated technology, but I love technology and I had sort of such high hopes for it. And I don't necessarily know what the step forward is. I guess when I wrote the book 5 years ago, my thinking was, well, it can't get any worse. And it's certainly gotten way, way worse. I think what you're starting to see now is sort of a collapse of even the sort of veneer of truth to media. And I think that sort of final bastion, the idea that, like, at least media was respectable, at least people had this sort of trust or projected a certain authority to the media, that's been sort of blown apart in the last 18 months or so. And so I think I guess the optimistic case would be things have gotten so bad that things are going to get better, and this is why you're seeing a surge in New York Times subscriptions and, you know, things like that. Or it's heading in a direction that we can't even comprehend, because what do you do when citizens cannot agree on what reality is or isn't?
I mean, I think the interesting thing is that we early journalists, and I put all of us in the same bucket, but somebody at Gizmodo and Gadget, Jezebel, yeah, Valleywag, all that stuff, we were making hamburgers really, really quickly and putting them on trays and slapping them out the window. Mm-hmm. And to us, everybody loved them. And to us, we thought to ourselves, look, everybody likes this stuff. Why should we sit down and make some locally grown parsnips over a lamb steak with a delicious gravy? Why should we do that when we can make 500 burgers a day, mm-hmm, and still make a lot of money doing it? And I think that mentality sort of poisoned the entire well. So nobody is making the delicious beautiful cuisine anymore. They're actually just slinging hamburgers, and at this point hamburgers have lost their buns and probably their pickle, and they're just like throwing meat out into the thing, and it's very frustrating. And I wonder if the answer is more New York Times subscriptions, or I wonder if there's a artisanal aspect to news that needs to come back out where people can actually appreciate it. I think one of the things that journalists think now is that they try to tell the truth, but nobody appreciates the truth, so they just give up, essentially.
I think that's right. I think there's been a couple things. So one of the big parts was that for people who don't totally understand the history of media, I think they think that media has always been advertising supported, right? So it didn't seem like a big shift to go, you know, as online media comes and then blogs, it didn't seem like a big shift to be entirely advertising supported. But that's not really true, right? For most of the 20th century, advertising was like extra revenue for newspapers. Mm-hmm. The majority of the revenue came from subscriptions, or at least that was the sort of baseline that covered the sort of costs of the institution. Mm-hmm. And was this sort of defining kind of governor on the craziness of the media system. Even cable news, you are paying for the news. You're giving the money to Comcast, who then turns around and gives $2 a person to CNN and $1 a person to Fox News. So when online media comes in and it's totally free, it's severing the contract between the reader and the creator. You know, as bad as McDonald's is, if people stopped going to McDonald's because they were getting sick, you know, and this has been true in Jack in the Box or Chipotle, if people stop going there because they're getting sick, McDonald's has to change, because, mm-hmm, like, if we're poisoning our customers, they're going to get upset and they're not going to come anymore. I think the problem with journalism, and this goes back to a much earlier phase in journalism, I think Walter Lippmann talked about this, when you're not entering into a contract with the person who's creating the thing, your incentives aren't aligned anymore. And so you sort of don't care if what you're making is good for people or what its ultimate effects is. You really are just caring if you can trick them into clicking it. And mm-hmm, I think that's been the sort of pervasive systemic problem of media for the last now going on 10 years.
Interesting. So I guess that leads back to, I mean, what that leads back to is two things. And we can talk a little bit about Stoicism as well, because that's actually a mental model that can be used to help control this. Because in the same way that McDonald's stimulates this, whatever, the hypothalamus or whatever, the yeah, gland in your brain that makes you happy, sliding through Facebook and sliding through Twitter all day long is just a, it's like prayer at this point. So you sit there and you do it. To pull people out of that mindset is really going to be difficult, and I would like to see how that works. But one of my pet projects is to work on some kind of payment system where every click you pay somebody 5 cents, and you're supporting a journalist. You're supporting if you post your book on there, you click on a chapter and you can read it for 5 cents, and that helps you and that helps everybody. And the inherent contract there is massively important, because I'm saying, Ryan wrote this cool thing, I want to read it, and I'm going to pay him for the privilege. But nobody wants to do that because they see 12,000 posts on BuzzFeed coming up a day where you can just slide through on Facebook and share the outrage with your friends quickly and easily.
Yeah. You know, Amazon has experimented with payments that way for sort of what the Kindle Unlimited program, which I think is interesting. And look, every time you create an incentive, people are going to gain that incentive, right? So you started seeing longer books on Kindle, and then maybe they tweak that, and you start to see someone take that long book and break it up into 20 books. So people are always going to game the incentives. But I think you make a good point about the sort of prayer aspect. I caught myself on, like, it was late last night. I went upstairs to check something, and I sat down on my computer, and I was, and then all of a sudden I'm checking Facebook and Twitter, and I'd ask myself, you know, I thought to myself in that second, like, how many times have I done this today? And how many times do I do this where I get something of actual value in return? And it's increasingly low, but I'm doing it more. And so I've made decisions over the last few months, like, for instance, just deciding to take Twitter off my phone has fundamentally changed my relationship with the service. It's almost like I'm realizing that, hey, when I just had blogs and some of these apps on my desktop, I interacted with them in a much healthier way than when I was also carrying them around in my pocket and I had unlimited access to them as well. So it might be that, like, look, McDonald's isn't the problem with McDonald's is if you eat it every day. If you eat it every once in a while, you'll probably be fine. I wouldn't do it, but you'll probably be fine. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's just these things are not great, but it's the mass with which we consume them that has really become the problem.
So why don't we talk a little bit about the books? What does the Stoic mindset mean to you, and how can that help us in this problem? And I mean, I think this is a wide-ranging problem. I think junk info is only just the tip of this iceberg. How can the Stoic mindset help us think better?
And it might seem strange that, like, this 2,000-year-old philosophy would be relevant today, but, you know, in ancient Rome, gossip is a problem, misinformation is a problem, rumors are a problem, getting caught up in trivialities and other people's business is a problem. So it's sort of the timeless human condition, which is that we only have so much time on this planet, but it's really easy, both psychologically and biologically, because of who we are, to waste that time on basically stuff that doesn't matter. And I think, you know, a philosophy of temperance and self-discipline, and also the sense that I think at its most core level, it's basically saying, like, what's in your control versus what's not in your control is actually perfect for today. So, like, I think one of the things I want to think about in my news diet is, like, am I going to do anything with this information? Like, is this substantively going to change my life, or does it have the potential to change my life? And if it doesn't, let's make sure that I'm not, like, ignoring my wife to read it, you know? And I think that's what we end up spending so much time on this stuff that people have made us think is very interesting, but it's fundamentally not practical or relevant. Like, I was thinking the other day, like, how much more news is there than there was before? I don't know, 1,000 times more, 1,000,000 times more. But we still have the same amount of time in a day, and we can still only act on the same amount of information. And so it's like they're trying, you know, if 2,000 calories is your average person's suggested intake, so we have someone trying to convince us actually we should be doing 4,000 calories or 8,000 calories. And so no wonder we're kind of obese.
What happens when we miss out? I think that's one of the things. I think the fear of missing out is been overused, but also, if our only diet, if our only food is McDonald's, how do we get any nutrition at all? Because if we cut it out, simply because we won't be able to hear the important bit of news that's embedded in between that, I don't know, they used to call Spicer Sphincter back in Connecticut, and that a girl with no legs played piano in Romania.
Right. Well, I think what happens is nothing, like absolutely nothing, right? That's the, like, you know, I haven't watched CNN since November, and I wouldn't say that I'm any less informed. It's that first there's this idea that the important news will find you, which I think is partly true. But also, I think we overstate how much, I think we underestimate information we can pick up from other sources and how little of it actually sort of matters. So, I mean, one of the things that I've thought about is like, okay, let's say I'm spending 20 minutes to read some Politico article. Mm-hmm. It's talking about what Trump may or may not do. Let's say, so if he does do it, maybe there's a 50% chance that that article will have some importance. And if it's about a may or may not, then there's a 50% chance it's a complete waste of time, right? Because like it could turn out to be nothing. Meanwhile, if I pick up a book about, you know, some historical event, which did happen, which has happened far enough in the past that a smart author has managed to create some lessons to learn from that thing, there's 100% chance that that information will be of utility to me. So I think maybe just making a calculation of like, how is this going to benefit me, and trying to take the surest shot, which I think tends to be going towards older information that has stood the test of time, will increase, you know, to continue this analogy, will increase the nutritional value in your information diet.
Okay, I'll buy that. So basically what you're saying for the future, we all have to stop going up to the window at McDonald's and sucking down what they have to offer, and go around the corner and sit down at a table and actually enjoy a croissant for a little while and enjoy life, really.
Yeah, it's being a bit more intentional about what you consume, so you're not just like, from a technology perspective, news providers have gotten almost as good as the makers of Candy Crush at how to sort of suck you into the system and turn it into a game that you want to win, you know? And deciding not to do that is a step of empowerment, is the first step in empowerment, I think. You know, actively, I'm not saying you should be uninformed. I'm saying you should be informed about the things that matter, but that also, and also take, you know, the Stoics are about taking, I think, the longer, more universal view of things. There's this wonderful essay Stoic thing that I talk about from Marcus Aurelius. He talks about taking Plato's view. You know, he basically means that going sort of up in the sky and looking down at the world, and how much smaller all these things that if you were at that level would seem like the most important thing in the world, right? I'm forgetting what the astronauts have a term for this, which I'm now forgetting, but they're talking about when you see the world from space for the first time, mm-hmm. almost every petty concern you have goes away because you see the plane. It's interesting to think it was only in the 70s, basically, that we got the 60s and 70s, that we could actually get that perspective for the first time. So in some ways, technology should be helping us get the longer view and the less sort of immediate short-term view, but somehow it's had the opposite effect. Somehow we're like, you know, Twitter tells us we need to consume what's going on in the world in real time, iteratively, as it's developing, which is probably the worst way to do it.
If you and I and a few other potential Stoics sat down and created a news organization doing exactly that, looking at the long view, taking careful, measured looks at the world, would anybody read it?
I don't know. Certainly, the Stoics, when they've written books, right, about various topics, have survived for literally thousands of years and have been read by millions of people. So, you know, Seneca, one of the famous Stoics, was arguably the most famous Roman poet of his lifetime. Playwright. So I don't think it's somehow, you know, and actually Ambrose Bierce was a famous Stoic. He's one of my favorite writers, and he was a newspaper reporter. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they're at all mutually exclusive. I just think that it's going to be less focused on sort of trivialities and instantaneousness, and it's going to be saying, you know, how is this information going to help me live my life? That's what philosophy is really designed to do. It's to help us live the quote unquote good life, rather than, you know, how to make more money or how to be smarter than someone else or any of these other things that might feel good but are really pretty empty.
Beautiful. Well, Ryan, thank you for joining us on the podcast. This has been enlightening. Maybe I'm going to have to – I think I'm going to delete my Facebook. I think that's the answer.
I don't think you should delete it because, one, you need it to log in to various other things.
Yeah, you're right.
but honestly, taking it off my phone means I check it 80% less,
sure.
You know? And don't install Messenger because Messenger is like crack. You know what I mean? Like the other thing I did is I turned off almost all the social media accounts from my phone, mm-hmm. and then I turned off all push alerts.
Interesting.
Other than text messages. So it's like, because I don't think that's a particularly new technology. So my phone is something I'm in control of rather than something that's like controlling me and let it, like, you need to check me now.
Yeah, sure.
I just buzzed. You have to check me now. I don't get much phantom ringing in my pocket anymore these days.
Interesting. And how long have you been doing this?
The social media stuff has been over the last year or so. And then definitely since the election, I just realized, like, I never consumed more news in my life going up to November. And it was such a great reminder of how little impact that ultimately had. And then I had my first kid the day after the election, mm-hmm. and it was sort of the perfect excuse to be like,
oh, absolutely.
What are you doing with your life here? You're in a hospital and you're trying to check some hot take on the election. And no, the person that you just brought into the world is not going to forgive you because you had to read this Talking Points memo piece.
Ryan, where can people find you online?
RyanHolliday.net. And then if you are on social media, I think I'm just at Ryan Holiday everywhere.
All right. Well, don't try to tweet him in the mornings or in the evenings, I guess, because you won't wake up out of your slumber and pull your phone to your face and stare bleary-eyed at it.
Exactly.
Instead, you'll sit at your desktop. Thanks for joining us on Technotopia. I'm John Biggs. We will see you next week.